kind of chapters 7, 8, and 9 is what's on the syllabus for tonight, and a few other readings that I thought are complementary to it. And I think I'll start by quoting Hayek on page 92 of my version. This is the 1976 version of The Road to Serfdom, of an older one, where he's talking about economic control, and it's not necessarily comprehensive central planning that he's referring to. He's referring to interventionism in general. And he says, economic control is not merely control of a sector of human life which can be separated from the rest. It is the control of the means for all of our ends. And whoever has sole control of the means must also determine which ends are to be served, which values are to be raised higher and which lower. In short, what men should believe and strive for. Central planning means that the economic problem is to be solved by the community instead of by the individual. But this involves that it must be also the community, or rather its representative, politicians that is, who must decide the relative importance of the different needs. And so when you go down the road of economic regulation, Hayek is saying, it's not only an economic matter, it's a means by which government can control all of your life eventually with enough economic interventionism. And an excellent example of this is the impending massive regulation and control of the healthcare industries in the U.S., where socialized healthcare is apparently about to be adopted. And of course, the government already regulates what Americans and most other developed countries as well eat, drink, and even the diet. The Food and Drug Administration regulates and controls what we eat, what we drink, and also it exerts enormous influence on the kind of food that is made available to the average person. And for many, many years, the kind of foods that have been made available have been dominated by the kind that the government wants us to eat, because the government collects billions of dollars from the agricultural industry or the pharmaceutical industry or some combination of the two or many others. And so the government, the U.S. government, has long had this food pyramid that was very grain-based. It was very based on grain, where the grains were so important to eat grain. And a lot of health advocates think that that's the opposite of what it should be for a healthy diet. And I think it's not just a coincidence that the government has, for many decades in the U.S., massively subsidized grain production so much that there have always been these massive surpluses. And there's a dilemma for the farmers in that, how do they get rid of all these massive surpluses that have been built up as a result of government policy in agriculture? And this is one way. This giant megaphone urges us to eat certain things. And so that's the main point Hayek is making here at the beginning of Chapter 7, in that economic regulation, economic control, economic planning really is a means of controlling your entire life, not just the money you make and your income and economic factors, but everything, your life itself. And certainly, if the government is in charge of hospitals, it's in charge of life and death decisions that will be made. He also talks then about the freedom to work and government interference in labor and labor markets. And there are a lot of ways in which government has long tinkered with the planning of labor markets. To just mention a few of the means, the occupational licensing, for example. Now, you can find examples of various occupations where licensing by the state seems reasonable to a lot of people. Almost anyone that I've ever talked to thinks it's a good idea that physicians are licensed, for example, although they could be licensed privately, as a lot of by trade associations, by the American Medical Association, for example. But state governments give the AMA or American Medical Association some quasi-governmental powers in issuing licenses and also in regulating the numbers of medical students. And that's just the medical field. And there are thousands of occupations in the United States where you cannot work unless you have a government-approved license. You could have 30 years of experience and a good reputation in performing a task, but if you do not have the appropriate government license, you can be out of business tomorrow. Every once in a while, when I'm talking about this in a university class, I'll go on the web if I have access to the internet in the classroom, and I'll look up, I'll type in price of taxicab medallions in New York City. And the taxicab business in New York City is, and in a lot of other cities, is regulated through occupational licensing. And in New York City, the licenses are called medallions. And the last time I looked this up, it was almost $1 million to become a cab driver in New York City. So you had to save up enough money to put a down payment on a loan for $1 million, or close to $1 million, to be a cabbie in New York City. And what a lot of people do is they share the medallion. There might be three owners of it, for example, who each go in for a third of $1 million in debt or close to it. And they have 3 8-hour shifts where they can use the medallion to be a legal cab driver in New York City. And there, as I said, there are literally thousands of occupations that are controlled. And from an economic perspective, the effect, if not the intent, of occupational licensing is always to create barriers to entry into the occupation. And more often than not, the advocates of these types of licensing laws and regulations are the people who are already in the industry who want to keep other people out. And so they make it, they make you have to jump through numerous hoops to enter the field. And sometimes the hoops are just ridiculous and time consuming. But that's the way it is if you want to enter that occupation. And so, and it works very well. Not just money, too. It's, there was a court case, a legal case, maybe 20-some years ago in the United States that was handled by a nonprofit law firm called the Institute for Justice in Washington, D.C. And I can recall this being on television. I think it was CBS 60 Minutes. And this is probably about 20 years ago, where there was a man and wife in Washington, D.C. who were doing nothing but braiding hair. They weren't cutting anybody's hair. They weren't putting chemicals in anyone's hair. They're braiding hair. And the government of Washington, D.C. came along and put them out of business because they did not have a cosmetology license. And they told them that they would have to go back to school for 2.5 years and earn a cosmetology license at the cost of many thousands of dollars. And, of course, it was the existing hairdressing businesses in D.C. who instigated this because they wanted to eliminate the prospect of competition by people who had these skills just showing up and putting a sign on their door, we braid hair, and so they created a barrier to entry. Fortunately, it turned out good. The Institute for Justice won the lawsuit against Washington, D.C., but this sort of thing happens all the time in America and in many other countries, occupational licensing. And, of course, government also has intervened in many ways with minimum wage and maximum hour laws, which is an abridgment of the freedom of contract. If I make a contract with you, I will pay you so much money, and you will do this work for me. You know, the U.S. Constitution supposedly protects freedom of contract, but, of course, it does not when it comes to minimum wage, maximum hour laws. And so this is an attack on freedom of association, if nothing else. And also labor unions. The only way a labor union can increase wages for its members above the free market level is to keep competing non-union workers out. Because in the United States, especially, if a union goes on strike, there's nothing stopping an employer from hiring replacement workers. And so that's the great risk if you go on strike in the U.S., that you can lose your job altogether. And so by some way, the unions have to keep other workers out. And there have been various laws over the years in the U.S. and other countries that strengthen unions and try to increase their ability to do this, to keep competing workers out of the workforce. And so the freedom of work is diminished to some extent by all this planning, government planning. And Hayek touches on this in chapter 7. Wes mentions barber licenses. Yes, that's there are all kinds of ridiculous licenses that people need to get to be a public school teacher in the United States. The requirements differ state by state. But it is true in some states you can have, say, a man who was an astrophysicist for his entire career, who was a near genius in mathematics, who retires and in his retirement would like to maybe teach high school math 9 months out of the year during the school year, just to be around young people and to sort of give something, make a contribution to his community. Well, in a lot of states, that man would have to go back to school and get a teaching certificate, even though the teachers he would be competing with are people who know nothing about math compared to his knowledge, having been a physicist for 40 years of his career. And so the only purpose of that would be to reduce competition and therefore prop up the wages of the people who are already in the business. And so that's one example of what Hayek is talking about here. And Hayek also mocks the idea that socialism or planning can lead to greater prosperity. And of course, you know, the whole world seemed to agree with that when socialism collapsed worldwide in the late 80s and early 90s. But then, Keynesianism, macroeconomic government planning is a resurrection of sorts of socialist central planning. The attempted control of interest rates by the Fed is a version of central planning. And so governments never give up on their impulse to plan everyone's life, even though we have the decades and decades of all kinds of planning, comprehensive and otherwise, that were a colossal disaster everywhere on earth. Politicians never give up. And so, but hardly anyone takes the idea seriously anymore that government planning will lead to greater prosperity. And although the Great Recession, so-called 2008, revived this thinking that we need government to come in and do more regulating and more planning in order to restore prosperity. And so we seem to have gone full cycle here from the collapse of socialism and everyone knowing planning doesn't work to a revival of these socialist ideas. And one of the more dangerous, in my opinion, areas of this revival is there's a big body of research and policy called happiness research. And the United Nations issued a big report on this. They call it the World Happiness Report. And so they purport to measure happiness country by country. And not unexpectedly, more often than not, what makes you happy, they say, is bigger government, higher government spending, more borrowing, more activism, more intervention, more regulation. That makes you happy. So the socialists of the world have given up on the idea, for the most part, seriously, that planning of an economy will make us more prosperous. But now they're saying it will make us happier. And there's a book, there's a couple of books about this that are written, published in Europe, although it's also popular in the U.S. and elsewhere. One's called The Spirit Level, and the other's called Affluenza. It says that affluence is a disease, like fluenza. So affluenza is the title. I'm not making this up. And there's an excellent critique of this idea of these books by a man named Christopher Snowden, S-N-O-W-D-O-N. And his book is entitled The Spirit Level Delusion, Fact-Checking the Left's New Theory of Everything. And I'll read one paragraph about this. Here's what he says. He says, apologists for Marxism have made myriad excuses for their ideology's failure to provide the same standard of living and liberty as was enjoyed in capitalist nations. Until recently, few have been so brazen as to claim that lowering living standards and curtailing freedom were the intended consequences of socialism, let alone that people would be happier with less of either, less freedom and less prosperity. In that sense, books like The Spirit Level represent a departure for the left. Now they're saying limiting freedom of choice, reducing wealth, and lowering aspirations are now openly advocated as desirable ends in themselves. And so that's where we're going. And so this is a good way to tie in Hayek's old warnings from the 1940s to something that's going on today. And a lot of this research is really a caricature of the abuse of statistics. They purport to find correlations between various government programs and happiness, and they seem to forget about the old lesson from statistics that correlation is not causation. As the old saying goes, if you torture the data long enough, it will confess. And I have a list here of some of the grandiose sounding conclusions that some of these authors in the happiness research have come up with. And they sound absolutely stupid to the average person, but these are written up in some of the highest ranked academic journals, and they're just common sense. I'll read a few of them. Persons with higher income have more opportunities to achieve what they desire. Who would ever have guessed? British lottery winners reported higher mental well-being the following year. What a shock. Quote, there is more to subjective well-being than just income, as though anyone has ever argued otherwise. Another quote, on average, persons living in rich countries are happier than those living in poor countries. Quote, happiness of unemployed persons is much lower than that of employed persons, end quote. Another quote, experiencing unemployment makes people very unhappy. This is the sort of malarkey that is found. And this was from an article in the Journal of Economic Literature, which is considered to be a top five academic journal in the economics profession, and it's pathetic. And so what the game is now, apparently, is to make the case that, well, yes, a planned economy won't make us more prosperous, but prosperity is a bad thing. It's affluenza. It's a sickness. And so what we need is less prosperity. That's what makes us happy. More unemployment. You know, if they contradict themselves. The quote I just said about how unemployed people are less happy than employed people, at the same time they say, well, lower income can make us happier after all. And so that's the new game with regard to socialism, is to say that government makes you happy. I wrote an article about this a couple of years ago on Mises.org. It was called The Trojan Horse of Happiness Research. And Cam may be able to find it. Hayek also in these chapters comes back to his old issue of private property as the cornerstone of freedom and prosperity, and how private property allows a person to have a sphere of separation from the state, where you can live your own life. If you own your body and you can own a business and you own your property, you can be an independent person. That's what is required to be an independent person. And from there, he goes on to make a very important point by asking a question. And the question, the way I would ask this same question is this. Ask yourself, who has more power over you? Bill Gates, who is one of the richest people in the entire world, the founder of Microsoft, or the lowliest, lowest paid government bureaucrat who works for the Transportation Security Administration at the airport? Who has a bigger effect on your life, or more power over you, I should say, to force you to do something? Bill Gates can't force anyone to do anything. He can only try to persuade you to buy his computers and his computer products, no matter how wealthy he might be. Whereas if in the United States, if you want to get on an airplane and fly somewhere, you have to stand there and take orders from some low IQ jerk who's a government employee who orders you around, tells you to lift your arms up, gropes you, puts his hand between your legs and elsewhere, supposedly looking for bombs, I suppose, and just making your life miserable. And so and Hayek makes this point about government planning, that the lowliest government bureaucrat can have more power over you and more negative influence over your life than the wealthiest person in the world. And that is certainly true. And another important point, this is a famous point that Hayek has made in many of his writings, is that I think the way he put it, I can paraphrase it, in that in a socialist society, the only power worth having is political power. And so you could have a corollary to that, is that by saying that the more socialized a society becomes, or the more that government planning becomes prominent in a society, the more important political power comes compared to any other kind of power. And in this, in understanding this more fully, I think you have to understand the relationship in economics between profit seeking and rent seeking, what economists call rent seeking. I prefer the phrase plunder seeking to rent seeking, but in economics literature, rent seeking has become popular. It doesn't mean rent that you pay a landlord. Rent, way to think of economic rent is just some sort of above normal profit, above average profit, above what it would take to get you to go to work or to get people to buy a product or to pay for a product, a monopoly profit, monopolistic profit of some kind. And so, you know, when you get involved, there are two ways to make money in a business. Let's say you and I are in the mousetrap business. We sell mousetraps. One way to make money selling mousetraps is to make your mousetraps better quality, longer lasting, and cheaper. Another way of making money of mousetraps is to convince the legislature to ban all foreign-made mousetraps from the country. That will reduce the supply in the market of mousetraps and allow you to charge a higher price as a result without giving the consumer anything at all in return. So protectionism, government subsidies of all sorts, government regulations that harm your competitors, these are all examples of rent-seeking, of attempts to make money by recruiting the government, having the government thwart competition in some way. Whereas profit-seeking is the old-fashioned way to make money, pleasing consumers better through better products and or lower prices. And so that's what Hayek is talking about. And the more pervasive government becomes, the bigger the premium is placed on gaining skills in politics. And when you think about it, that means that young people in a politicized society, fewer and fewer of them will go to engineering school or business school, and more of them will go to law school and learn how to be lobbyists and public relations specialists or people who are adept at influencing politics, influencing governments. And from an economic perspective, the cost of that is that there will be a lot of foregone production. Fewer people become producers. More and more people are engaged in using the government to redistribute wealth from the less politically powerful to the more politically powerful. The whole society becomes poorer. And that's the warning Hayek was giving back in the 1940s. And even though modern economics, beginning around the 1980s, started calling this rent-seeking, it's a very old idea. And the modern economists just rephrased this very old idea with their language. Hayek also gave a warning, a sort of a perennial warning, about how the socialists of the world always zeroed in on the indoctrination of children. Their objective was always to try to take over the schooling system. He was certainly right about that. And this is in the chapter called Whom? You know, who is to do the planning? Whom is to do the planning? And what will be the results? Is the question he's asking. Who will be the winners and losers? And he asked the question, well, how will the poor of society, the poorer people, fare in a politicized society, planned society? And he's anticipating here the work in economics in the field of public choice or the economics of political decision making. And the main point here is that, of course, the poor are never very good at politics because for a number of reasons. And it's the more affluent that are good at politics. And so the more politicized an economy becomes, the more likely it is that the power of government will be used to benefit the more affluent, often at the expense of the poor. Sort of a slightly cruder way to put it is the main reason why a lot of people are poor is that they're simply not that talented. And there's no reason to believe that they will all of a sudden become super talented as political activists when they were not talented enough to earn a very high income in the marketplace. But the people who are talented, who are highly educated, and so forth. Well, they will figure out how to influence politics in the government, and they will use the government for their own benefit, often at the expense of the poor. And so there's no inherent reason to believe that a politicized society will be better for poor people rather than worse. It very well may be much worse for poor people, to be sure. And the final point of discussion in this series of chapters is security and freedom. And this is certainly relevant to today's world, the war on terror, as George W. Bush called it, spelled T-E-R-R-A. And Hayek is hinting here about the old saying that is attributed to Benjamin Franklin, that people who think that they can trade off some freedom for more security will end up with less of each, less freedom and less security. And Ben Franklin had in mind what economists call the moral hazard problem. And for example, the moral hazard problem is that in the welfare state, in the name of increasing the economic opportunities of the poor, we pay the poor to not work. It's called welfare. And so as a result of this, the welfare states of the world have created a welfare trap, whereby if you quit welfare and go to work and you lose all those benefits, your effective tax rate might be very high. It might be 50 or 60 or 70% in terms of all the welfare benefits that you lose by taking a job. And so a lot of the welfare states, like the United States, have made it uneconomical for poor people to get off of welfare, because they're better off economically staying on welfare and not becoming financially independent. That's called a moral hazard problem. And so in ostensibly the purpose of the welfare state is to increase economic security by allowing people to have to be able to get along and earn and make enough money to have a decent life. But in the end, the effects of it are more economic insecurity, because people are paid to not do what it takes to become economically independent. That is, get a job, keep a job, acquire skills, grow the skills, accumulate more skills, and so forth. And so the welfare state has destroyed all that. And there are many other examples of this moral hazard problem. But Hayek talks about several of these in his chapter 9 on security and freedom. Unemployment insurance, in the same way, in the name of reducing unemployment, we pay people in the United States anyway up to 2 years to remain unemployed. So of course this increases the unemployment rate, because people can get paid a high percentage. In some states it's 60% or so of what they were earning. And you don't have to go to work, you don't have to buy work clothes, you don't have to buy food at work, you don't have to pay for gasoline to get to work. So it's a pretty good deal. You encourage people to remain unemployed longer, and that's a moral hazard problem. And I've included on the reading list, to complement this particular chapter, an essay by Murray Rothbard on egalitarianism as a revolt against reason. Since Hayek here is talking about welfare state institutions, basically, and the problems and how they create a more insecure life for the people who are on welfare. One of the essential points that Rothbard makes, a very obvious point, Ludwig von Mises made this point also, is about how it is that what makes an economy work is the international division of labor. Human beings all have different preferences, different abilities, different intelligence levels, different levels of physical strength, different interests, many, many biological differences too. And as a result, in the workplace, we all specialize in something. We all do something, and we use that skill that we accumulate in our work lives to make money, and then we use the money, a medium of exchange, to purchase products from other people who have different skills. So I do what I do. I'm a college professor and a writer, and I make money doing those things, and a speaker. And I use that to do things I can't do, like grow food or manufacture automobiles or build houses. The international division of labor, it's what makes the world work. And of course, what determines what we get paid is supply and demand. It's the supply of people doing this particular thing, and also the demand for our services, which is a derived demand from the demand for the product or the service. And so, naturally, we all have different abilities, interests, skills, levels of experience, seniority. That's why we all make different incomes. And so for governments to try to force equality of income, Rothbard called it a revolt against nature, and it certainly is, because God made every one of us a unique individual, and there's no reason to believe that we can do better than God and force everyone into equality. There's a rabbi named Daniel Lapin, spelled L-A-P-I-N, who gave a very interesting talk at the Mises Institute a couple of years ago on economic freedom. You can look it up on Mises.org. I think it's something like The Case for Economic Freedom, something like that, Daniel Lapin. And he ended his talk, or near the end of his talk, he made a nice metaphor. He asked the people in the room, ask yourself this, would you prefer to think of yourself as a brick or a stone? A brick or a stone? And what he's saying is that bricks are man-made. And so it is possible for us to make every brick identical. When you see a nice house, a nice brick house in your neighborhood, the bricks are all identical. They're all man-made. But this is a Jewish rabbi, Daniel Lapin, and so he goes on to say that God made all the stones, however, and every stone is different. No two stones are the same. And so then he asks again, well, how would you like to think of yourself? Is a man-made brick that made by the state identical to every other person in the image of the state? Or would you like to think of yourself as an individual, God-made individual, not as a man-made that is made by the state or politician? And, of course, most of the people in the audience would think, well, yeah, I'd like to think of myself as an individual. And it is what we are. And so... so it's a revolt against reason, and Hayek is talking about this in his chapter 9 on security and freedom, when he's talking about the institutions of the welfare state and how they lead to insecurity, economic insecurity, not more security. And it's because of this moral hazard problem. And so I thought I would complement that with the Rothbard article about this. And there, I see Cam on the chat found the speech by Rabbi Lapin on what is morally right about economic freedom. And it's a long speech, about an hour long. I show it to my undergraduate classes at the university. And of course, finally, another article I've put on there is on the syllabus for tonight. It's a book review by James Ostrowski, who's a great libertarian lawyer from Buffalo, New York. It's a book review of The Black Book of Communism. And because I thought I wanted to make the point that in all this talk that Hayek is beginning to get into on equality and government planning, of course, the only way to do this is to pursue this agenda is to supersede the plans of individuals with the plans of government. How do governments do this? Well, they use force and coercion. That's what government is, force and coercion. And the Black Book of Communism gives chapter and verse of hundreds of different ways in which governments in the 20th century used coercion, force, violence, and mass murder to try to impose central plans, socialistic plans on their countries. And they ended up killing 80 to 100 million of their own people, according to the Black Book of Communism. Not in war. These are not wartime deaths. These are extermination of individuals by their own governments for resisting the government's plans. And I think it's always important to keep that sort of thing in mind when you talk about government planning, because the advocates of planning, whether they call themselves socialists or liberals or whatever, are always taking the moral high road. They're always condemning the profit seekers of the world and the greedy capitalists and they call libertarians lunatics and so forth. They're always taking the moral high road. But in reality, they are in bed, so to speak. They are associating themselves with the most evil mass murderers in the history of the planet. These are their ideological bedfellows. the people who tried every which way to adopt socialism and central planning, and they inevitably resorted to mass murder of dissenters to try to get their way in the 20th century. And so, I couldn't put the whole book, of course. I didn't want to put the whole book, The Black Book of Communism. I don't think it's online anyway. But Ostrowski's review of it gives you an idea of what it's about. There's also a website that talks about this gloomy subject by Rudolf Rummel. It's spelled R-U-M-M-E-L-L, I believe. And he's written a book called Death by Government. And I think the website is called Death by Government. He also calls it democide, killing by government, democide. And he has books that he's written of that, of those titles, Death by Government and democide. And he also details the statistics, such as they are, on the murder of dissenters by government in the, all throughout the 20th century. And into the 21st century, Rudy Rummel. He has a website that you can look at. It's a very gloomy piece of research. I don't know how somebody could spend their career doing this. It's very, very gloomy and dark, but Rudolf Rummel has done it. And so I think that's the last point I wanted to make about these three chapters on Hayek for tonight. I wanted to touch on those points and try to amplify some of them. And so I'll do what we always do and see if we have some Q&A questions from the audience, and I'll do my best to try to answer them. I see Cam is doing his great job as always. Let's see, Jack is commenting up here that he read that the country with the happiest population also had the highest suicide rate. In the United Nations report on happiness, they listed Greece as way up near the top, if not the top. And the report came out shortly before there were riots in Athens over the bankruptcy of the Greek government. And it hardly, there is a free download of the Black Book of Communism nowadays, I see. So it's Cam put it on the chat. In one of my classes, university courses on capitalism and its critics, I had the students read and we discussed in class The Road to Serfdom, basically this course, and then I had them write a paper about from the Black Book of Communism, picking any one country and writing a short paper on how the government of that country, what type of force and coercion they used in Poland or Cuba or China or wherever in the name of adopting socialism, because I wanted them to learn the ugly truth of that. Yeah, Wes has a question about getting Hayek's messages across in our schools. Well, I think every parent has to be a homeschool parent to some degree. Even if you send your kids to school, you have to supplement their education so that when they're old enough, they'll be thinking for themselves, and you won't have to remind them that their teacher is brainwashing them in propaganda. They'll recognize it immediately. I've seen it over and over again and among homeschool kids. And so I think the only way out is to take your kids out of public schools, sure. But the private schools are often not much better because the teachers, most of the teachers are trained at government institutions, and they all learn the same things. And so, to some extent, everyone has to be a homeschooler. Let's see, Jack is also asking, is there evidence that about Hayek is right and Keynes was wrong? Yes, there's a video called The Commanding Heights. It's a PBS video series. I think it's a three-part series. Volume one is all about the great debate between Keynes and Hayek, and it ends by with Hayek winning the Nobel Prize and being right after all. It starts in the period of World War One, and it talks about the Keynesian Revolution and how famous and rich Keynes became while Hayek became a nobody and he was forgotten. But then it ends with the collapse of British socialism, the collapse of socialism all over the world, Hayek winning the Nobel Prize, the Chicago School of Free Market Economics and the Ascendancy. And they do a really good job of telling the whole story. And it's not perfect. I had some criticisms of video, but it's called The Commanding Heights. And there's a book by the same title, The Commanding Heights. And so if you, and it's online. You can see it online. And so that's where you have to get a lot of honest Keynesians to admit it. Yeah, the battle of ideas. It's all about Keynes and Hayek. Yeah, I see Cam found it. Okay. Yeah, there's a question from, I think it's Sarah. Why did the free market advocates fail so miserably on the moral high ground area? Well, it's the total government control of the school system, the K through 12 especially, but the universities also are almost all of them government. If they're not entirely government funded, they get most or half or a big chunk of their money from government. And so that's what they preach. Government is moral and proper and right, and it takes care of us. It protects us from the avarice of the private sector. And it's hard to make a headway into that. Although we're much better off today than we were 20, 30, 40 years ago in that regard. You know, Wes Kent says, as he recalls, that Friedman commented that Keynes would be shocked at the extent to which his principles had been applied. Well, maybe, maybe not. You know, Keynes would have evolved in his thinking just as Friedman did. And so you can never tell. And Jack wants to know, are Keynesians just ignorant? Of, you know, why do people like Paul Krugman never give up? In the face of all evidence. Well, you know, Thomas Sowell has written several books about this. Let's see what's the name of his book. Maybe I'll think of it eventually. I might have to wait till next time. But Thomas Sowell, the economist and columnist, in one of his books, he takes on this question, you know, why in the face of sometimes decades of evidence do the Keynesians or other leftists just not admit that they've been wrong? And his explanation is that what matters most to people like this is to be able to strut around pretending to be morally superior to everybody else. And it doesn't really matter that their ideas cause problems and make things even worse. What matters to them is to announce that they care more than you do. And by caring, they always mean the endless additions to government interventionism in the name of helping the poor or whoever their name is. That's what matters to them. Evidence and history doesn't matter to them. And so he argues that they're not generally interested in helping the poor. They're generally interested in shouting to everybody who will listen that I care more than you do about the poor. So it's all about them. And so I'll think of it as the title of Sowell's book for next time. But that's kind of an intriguing explanation of that, because this question has come up many times before. Let's see, there's a question about an international central bank. I think the European Union is collapsing. We're witnessing the collapse of the euro and the European Union. And so the question is, does Mises' thoughts apply to this? I think they certainly do, the eurozone. And I think it's bound to fail. You know, it's been bailed out. They're bailing each other out. the Germans have been bailing out the Greeks, for example. The United States bailed out quite a few of the European central banks. And so the U.S. Fed bailed out some of the European central banks to keep this whole racket going. But we're witnessing right now with some of the riots and the collapse of some of the European welfare states, we're witnessing the collapse of the euro and the European Union. Cam is asking if the book is Intellectuals in Society. The book I'm thinking of has a different title, but he might have written an essay about that title. It sounds like if it's an essay, it's probably the same theme as his book. And I don't know if I can't recall if he's written a book by that title. It just popped in my head. The Vision of the Anointed. The book is called The Visions of the Anointed by Thomas Sowell. Let's see. I'll see if there's any questions on the Q&A. Let's see, the question about the Scandinavian countries. Well, the Swedish welfare state has been imploding for a long time, and there is a loss of freedom. We haven't turned into totalitarian societies, but certainly when the government of Sweden takes 60 or 65% of your income, that's a tremendous loss of freedom to live your life in the way that you want to live, and that you have to live your life to a very large extent in the way the Swedish government wants you to live. And so, the title of the book is not serfdom, it's The Road to Serfdom. And so it's all a matter of where Sweden is or where other countries in Europe are on that road to serfdom. And it might take many years. You know, the communists, the difference between a communist and an American liberal like Barack Obama is that the communists were in a big hurry and were willing to murder millions of people to get there. Whereas the so-called liberals in America are not quite as vicious and not quite as in a hurry. For example, they sort of relish the fact that they have been attempting socialized medicine since the early 20th century, and they finally think that they have succeeded. And so they don't mind that it took a whole century to get their way in that. Whereas communists were kill everybody who dissents and oppose communism on the world. That's what they were about. I don't know, Graham asked about collectivism gaining its attractiveness. Well, yes, that's one of the reasons why I'm teaching this course, is to encourage more people to read books like The Road to Serfdom and to think about these warnings that Hayek gave. What hope is there? I've been around for about 30-some years in this whole movement, free market economics, Austrian economics, the Ron Paul movement. Ron Paul interviewed me on his TV program that he had when he was a member of Congress in 1983. So I've been around these circles for a long time. And back then, you could fit us all into a small room. But today, there are institutes and think tanks all over the world. There are Mises Institutes in all over Europe now, and Asia, Latin America. And there's a Canadian Mises Institute. And all sorts of other think tanks and organizations with like-minded people. And there's the internet. And so the most encouraging thing to me as an American has been in recent years is the young people by the millions who discovered Ron Paul, the politician, and who became so popular by espousing these ideas. And he still is hugely popular, starting up his own television network now. And he has his own website, he has a Peace and Prosperity Institute. And so this is where, and it's very, very encouraging that it's so many younger people that are doing this, because they're going to, some small percentage of them is going to become very influential in the future. And who knows what they will achieve. Let's see, there's a question about the question on the quiz. Production for use is certainly different. There is no difference, really. Production for use, you cannot make a profit unless you produce something that is useful. And so the socialists who were condemning the profit system thought that whether there is a difference. I mean, you can produce some things that are useful to people, and then you can produce other things that are only for profit. They're not useful. Well, in a market economy, you can't make a profit unless the product is useful. And so that's the point about the old canard that socialism will produce products for use but not for profit. The students, a lot of students I run into, when you show them these logic and facts about the market economy and about the political economy, Austrian economics, and so forth, a lot of them resent the fact that they've been miseducated. They realize immediately that they've been miseducated, and their other professors don't like it because they all of a sudden can ask questions of them, and I of course enjoy that sort of thing a lot, but there's a lot of that going on. Let's see, any more questions, dear? Now we seem to be running out of gas, I guess. This wasn't a big chunk of literature to tackle tonight. I hope you learned something. Okay. Well, I guess we'll call it a night then, and if we run out of questions, thanks again for participating. And we'll learn more next week. I'll be teaching the class next week from the Mises Institute, probably in Danny Sanchez's office. And so we'll see you then.